Great, thank you. Good morning. Apologies for the late start this morning. Good morning and welcome, everyone. Thank you for being with us today in person and online. I would like to call this August 23rd Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board hearing to order. It is 9:05. This is a hybrid meeting, which includes a physical meeting location at the County of Santa Cruz Board of Supervisors Hearing Room at 701 Ocean Drive. There is also an option for online remote participation through the Zoom webinar platform. If you would like to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board's customary website is also available. We will be receiving information from hearing participants and public comment both in person and virtually. The Zoom meeting link has been made available along with the public speaker online request forms via our agenda website and meeting participation page. If you are a remote presenter or member of the public who would like to comment, you should already be in the Zoom webinar attending using the meeting link provided on the board's website, and you should have submitted an online speaker request form. Requests to provide public comment for items on today's agenda will be accepted up to the start of each agenda item. If you wish to comment on an item and have not submitted a public comment request card, please do so now by either submitting an online comment card request through the remote meeting link located on the agenda. For those of you who are physically present at this hearing location, blue comment cards are located at the back of the room, and you may submit that comment card now. If you are having trouble accessing the online meeting link, online speaker request form, or the webcast link, please contact the clerk of the board at rb3-commentletters@waterboards.ca.gov. Remote presenters and speakers will be on mute with cameras turned off. Once it's your time to speak, you will be asked to unmute yourself and turn on your camera, if you have one. When you're done with your comments and the board members have completed the questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You're welcome to remain in the Zoom webinar as an attendee for the duration of the item and the hearing. You may also exit the Zoom webinar or follow along on the webcast. Again, this meeting and all Water Board meetings are being recorded and will be available for viewing on the website. Because this, again, is being recorded, we encourage you to speak into the microphone slowly and clearly. We at the Water Board would like to acknowledge that all the lands and waters within the Central Coast region are the unceded tribal lands of many tribal ancestors. We acknowledge the historical wrongdoings committed against California Native American tribes. Actions taken at this hearing and those actions taken throughout the Central Coast Water Boards are in hopes of advancing the collective goal of truth and healing. Again, good morning, and thank you for being here. So the next item on our agenda is the roll call. May we have a roll call?
Chair Gray?
Present.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Present.
Member Hunter?
Present.
Member Rodriguez?
Present.
Member Harlan?
Present.
Member Hoskins?
Present.
Thank you. We also have introductions, and I'll turn it over to our Executive Officer, Ryan Lodge.
Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the board. My name is Ryan Lodge. I'm the Executive Officer for the Central Coast Water Board. I'll be introducing staff this morning. We have our Assistant Executive Officer and Temporary Clerk to the Board, Taya Tryon, our Central Coast Water Board Legal Counsel, Sophie Froelich, and Section Managers Angela Schroeder, Mary Hamilton, and Harvey Packard. I'd also like to introduce this morning the new Executive Director to the State Water Board, Eric Oppenheimer. Eric took on the executive director position in January, and we appreciate him taking time this morning to introduce himself to the Central Coast Water Board.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge. Good morning, Mr. Oppenheimer. Welcome, and thank you for being with us this morning.
Good morning, Chair Gray and board members, and thank you, Ryan. Thank you for the opportunity to take a moment of your time today. As Ryan said, my name is Eric Oppenheimer. I am the newish, at this point, executive director for the State Water Board. I've been on the job since January, so I think I'm coming up on 8 months at the end of August, which certainly isn't a huge amount of time for really any position, but certainly not this one. I'm certainly not new to state government either. I'm coming up on 30 years of state service, most of that time spent with the state and regional water boards, and most of that time actually spent serving as an environmental scientist in some capacity or another. I've held a number of management and executive roles at the State Water Board, I've also worked for, I think it was almost a decade at the regional water boards. My time was split between Region 6, where I started, actually started there as a student assistant in the South Lake Tahoe office, and then also spent roughly 5 years with the Central Valley Regional Water Board. And I mentioned that just to hopefully impress on you that I am familiar with many of the programs that you have to implement. I've implemented or worked on implementing many of them myself. And so I feel like I have a good appreciation of your work and probably more importantly, the challenges associated with implementing the regional board programs and working at a regional board, least of which is just resource constraints and essentially really, you know, not having enough resources to fully implement the mission in all places and really needing to prioritize. So I am sensitive to that. I just have to say, I'm just so appreciative to the State Water Board for them putting their confidence in me, for helping me to achieve their priorities. And that's really what I am laser focused on. I also really appreciate the partnership that I've been building with your executive officer, Mr. Lodge. I feel like I'm getting to know him better, and it's just been a great opportunity to, again, build a partnership. Really looking forward to continuing to build on that and working to help Ryan achieve his goals and to help him help you achieve your priorities. On that note, I just will mention that these are very, you know, challenging budget times, as I think everybody is aware. Two big aspects of the recently adopted budget that pose particular challenges to us are the budget's call for an elimination of 10,000 vacant positions statewide, which will affect the water boards. And then also on top of that, a reduction in 7.95% from agency operation expenditures. So it's really two combined actions as a result of the budget that is going to further constrain our resources, which obviously is always a difficult thing. We're currently working through what that's going to look like. But it's going to affect all of us at the state board, at the regional boards, at our regional and division offices. It's going to be a challenge. And I think it's really going to require all of us to refocus and ascertain our priorities and what we can do. And maybe, you know, some of the things that we're going to have to postpone as a result of these resource reductions that we're faced with. And so I remain, even with these reductions, I remain optimistic that we still have a lot of excellent, extraordinary people, and optimistic about our ability to collectively advance our priorities and achieve our most important priorities. And so I don't know if you all have any questions for me, but again, I just really appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself and looking forward to working with you. Also, I will mention I saw the Senate confirmed your board member, Pierre Wolf. Congratulations, board member Pierre Wolf. Looking forward to continuing to work with you. We've worked together for quite a long time now, and I really value that relationship. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Oppenheimer. Appreciate you being with us this morning. I'm going to open it up to my board colleagues for questions or comments. Yes, Jean-Pierre.
Yeah, just a quick shout out to you also when, you know, I found out that you were the chosen one for the position. I thought, can't think of a better person, particularly because of the internal promotion, and I value the fact that, as you stated, you know, you have a lot of experience both at the regional level and at a state level. So I know we're in good hands, so thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. I think you've sufficiently provided an introduction, and we really appreciate you again being here. I think it's a testament to the internal promotion structure, and I'm happy to hear that you understand the challenges and the competing interests that we have internally to prioritize. It's never easy, and certainly within a budget year where there's a lot of competing cross interests and not enough staff, frankly, and not enough budget to accomplish the extremely important goals that we have here at the State of California. But I'm glad you understand that. So, thank you very much again for being here. We really appreciate it. And I've seen you on chair's calls, obviously, and appreciate you taking some time to speak with us here today. So wishing you a wonderful weekend, and thanks again for your time.
Same to you. Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is item number 12, consideration of proposed, I'll let Mr. Lodge introduce it.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gray. Item 12 is in the uncontested items calendar. It's item to consider proposed order R3-2024-0035, which is a general waiver for specific types of limited threat discharges. The proposed order is a renewal of an existing general waiver that has gone through several iterations since originally being adopted in 2002. The waiver must be renewed every 5 years, and it was last revised in September of 2024. Just last year, there was a minor revision that came before you. So it will expire next month, because that was not a full renewal. The general waiver does not include any substantive changes. It was publicly noticed with 30-day public notice period. No comments were received during that time. The general waiver streamlines staff time and allowing discharges that are a limited threat to water quality, particularly helps in our cleanup programs. So item 12 is uncontested, so there is no staff presentation.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to approve the order?
So moved.
Thank you. A second?
I'll second.
Great. Maybe have a roll call vote, please.
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Rodriguez?
Aye.
Member Hunter?
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
Member Hoskins?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Great to hear we can streamline a few things and save some staff time. The next item on our agenda is a land disposal program update. Mr. Lodge.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Item 13 is we'll have Martin Fletcher. He's a water resource control engineer in the land disposal program. He's here to present the land disposal program update along with Joey Sisk. He's the land disposal program manager and senior water resource control engineer.
Good morning, Chair Gray and members of the board. Give us one moment to pull our things together here. Thanks.
Take your time. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, Chair Gray, members of the board. My name is Martin Fletcher. I'm a water resource control engineer here at the Central Coast Water Board. Today, I will be presenting a land disposal program update informational item to provide a general update on activities related to our Central Coast Water Board's land disposal program. Today's presentation begins with a brief introduction. Staffing, facilities, permitted and applicable state and federal regulations. This will be followed by some background information on the facilities we regulate, which include landfills, compost operations, and surface impoundments. Finally, I will provide an overview of the land disposal program's annual priorities and how we are moving forward to address emerging contaminant issues such as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS. Our staff includes Jordan Hasserot and myself, who are full-time within the land disposal program, Nick Smera, who works within both the land disposal program and the active oil fields program, and Joey Sisk, seated next to me, who is the program manager and for the land disposal and the active oil fields program. The land disposal program oversees 56 permitted waste disposal sites, including 15 active landfills and 41 closed landfills. Most of our waste disposal sites are landfills that have accepted or continue to accept municipal solid waste. We also regulate 10 compost facilities and one permitted but inactive surface impoundment facility. Landfills in California are regulated through state and federal requirements, including California Code of Regulations Title 27 and Code of Federal Regulations Title 40, Parts 257 and 258. Landfills must also comply with the Port of Colon Water Control Act, or the California Water Code, and the Central Coast Basin Plan.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fletcher, I'm going to interrupt you, if that's okay. Can we just go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of those active landfills, how many will be expected to expand, or if there are any new landfills proposed?
All the landfills are generally constantly expanding that we have. If we were looking at closures, we have one that I know of that is in its final phases, and then we have another landfill that hasn't been constructed yet that we permitted actually approximately 2014. It had to go, it's now had to go undergo some design changes which are going to force environmental review. So that one will hopefully come back to us, at least with regards to changes in the next year or so.
Thank you. Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, and that, thank you. And as a follow-up to Chair Gray, and if this was going to be part of your presentation, I have no problem, you know, you covering that later. But as we talk about expanding landfill, increasing capacity of landfill, I'd like to hear about the effect of the increased amount of green waste which are being diverted for composting and also food waste, you know, as part of the requirements to reduce the impact on landfill. So if you already have a sense of what impact that has in terms of, you know, the amount of cubic yards of waste on the landfill, I would appreciate that. And like I said, if you know you want to weave this in your presentation, I'm fine with that.
Now I can address that a little bit now. In general, recycling expands the lifespan of a landfill. They are trying to meet really strong diversion goals. As State Board 1383 requires 75% diversion for organics. I think landfills are working really hard to try to meet that. Having said that, our populations are growing in communities. The economy goes up and down, and when the economy is roaring, they are receiving lots of waste. When it's a recession, it slows down a lot. So these lifespans are built into our joint technical documents. They try to give us an idea of how long, when they're going to do the expansions. But in general, we have limited facilities, and they're already regionalized to some extent, and so they have predictable waste coming in. And when they give us expansion designs, we not only do we prioritize it from a water quality standpoint, but we have to prioritize it because if we don't get it approved, they don't have the expansion in a year or two that they need to continue placing waste. This picture shows an active disposal area at the Santa Maria Regional Landfill. What's interesting about it, different landfills allow the public into those active areas. You can see a car there that is dropping off. Other landfills might receive waste from the public and have a specific an area to drop off. Then they move that waste up to the landfill, and it helps them divert more waste because in those areas they will have staff ensuring that if there's something that should be recycled, that it ends up getting recycled. Landfill waste management units are divided into four classes based on type and risk. Class one facilities accept hazardous waste, and they have the most protective set of requirements. There are no active operating class one facilities within our region. We have two closed class one sites that we help oversee. The California Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, is the lead oversight agency for class one facilities. Class two facilities accept designated waste. Designated waste is hazardous waste that has received a variance from DTSC or is a non-hazardous waste that can impact water quality, which you can imagine is a broad definition. We have one active class two landfill and one.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fletcher. We have another question. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. I apologize for the interruption, but I think asking questions as you go along hopefully works out for you too. Works out for me. I'm wondering on the class two where they have a variance for depositing hazardous waste. How then is that material managed in the landfill?
Okay. They often have special disposal rules. So, for example, asbestos is kind of one that triggered that needs to be buried and contained so that it's not an airborne type issue. But we have limited, and then another example would be, I think, the military bases and having some lead-impacted tiles. They will give a variance, and then they'll have special disposal, maybe not breaking up into tiny pieces. They'll try to dispose of it in large chunks so that there's less solubility for that lead to come off.
Yeah, and will you be speaking about military sites more specifically? Because I am interested in how we, what is our relationship to those landfills? Do we have any authority over federal military bases?
Yeah. I think we have a long history in our DOD program of working with our military bases. I think in the landfill program, because we have such specific regulations with regards to Title 27 and federal requirements, I haven't seen too much pushback with regards to getting things implemented for landfills and working with. I think with often with military bases, the issue is funding, and if you get it on their radar screen early, then you have a better chance of them getting incorporated into future budgets. So I think some patience sometimes works best.
So you as staff, you have some correspondence or you are making them aware that we know that they have a landfill and they're, so you have some role in that.
Yes, we inspect the facilities. We are permitting and we interact with the equivalent of solid waste managers or their environmental personnel. But we do the same thing with our private and our, I mean, the more we talk with them, the more we can give them a heads up, the more we usually can work together.
Okay, great.
Mr. Lodge, think you came from that program, so.
Just building on what Mr. Fletcher was saying is that we have a really good relationship with our DOT sites, and they have permits with us. They have compliance. Some of them have compliance issues, but as Mr. Fletcher indicated, a lot of times it's just programming the money in because they have federal budgets that they have to deal with.
Yeah.
And so we have a really good working relationship with them. And they have, you know, they're really not much different than working with our private or our small municipal dischargers in that program.
Do we have enforcement authority over those landfills?
Yes, we do. We try not to get to that point because it's a different game for the DOD folks.
Right.
But we try to work with them. I mean, what's unique about this program is most of the operators, because the requirements are so prescriptive and they've been in place for so long, they understand what the requirements are and they understand that all the facilities are held to the same standard. So there's typically not a lot of pushback.
Sorry about that. Jesus.
It's just a matter of timing, and we have to have a little bit more patience with the federal facilities because it does take them a little bit longer to get the funding in place to get the work done.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that because my impression was we really didn't have much to say or do with the military bases. So I'm glad I was wrong about that.
Yeah. I mean, it is a little bit different than our private or municipal facilities. Mm-hmm. Our enforcement authority is not as strong, I think, but there are federal requirements, and they do take those seriously.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes, Ms. Hoskins.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you so much for the presentation. I keep looking at this photo and wondering, in general, what percent of the waste that's going into the class three. This is a picture. Is this a picture of class two or class three?
Yeah, it's a class three landfill.
Class three, right. How effective are we being in getting the recyclable and the waste that isn't supposed to be there kept from there? I mean, do we have a sense, is it, 70% or 80%? I mean, I can tell you I'm probably not careful enough in separating out my home waste. So I'm just wondering how we think that's working. And if it's not, closer to 100%, the kind of actions that are being taken just to educate the public. Because I think if the public saw more of these pictures, they might realize, that waste is going somewhere. How can we reduce the amount that's going into the landfill?
Yeah, we don't require recycling. It's from our standpoint, and so we work with CalRecycle, and CalRecycle has the mandates and is working with the dischargers. It's important for us to be involved because often there's water quality concerns with recycling. As soon as you start to pull waste out and create piles and put in compost and all that, we tend to be applying and requesting efforts to protect water quality, and CalRecycle tends to view that sometimes as a hindrance to their goals of getting recycling because operators have budgets and typically the recycling is not something that they make money on. Having said that, I think that all of our landfills have dedicated procedures to try to both bring in recycling through from the users with regards to separate bins, but then also separate out as they receive it as the public drops off. And then they do utilize spotters, and each landfill has their own independence on how they react to a situation in which they might receive lots of recyclable goods in the are they able to go back and figure out who gave that to them and educate them? From a numbers perspective, because we're not implementing and requiring that, that's kind of hidden to us. I just tend to look at it from a standpoint that how can we work with CalRecycle to help them move quickly or help operators move quickly towards developing composting and those types of operations.
And I would like to add, thank you, Martin, to that just a little bit to clarify that CalRecycle is the lead agency in regards to the recycling requirements. So there are recycling requirements. We don't enforce them. That's wholly within the realm of CalRecycle. And sometimes the recycling can cause additional threats to water quality, which could cause additional expenditures. So sometimes it takes, so we're trying to work collaboratively with CalRecycle to both implement recycling without adding additional threats to water quality.
Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead, Mr.
Well, we do have some facilities that have materials recovery facilities mm-hmm. at the landfills. So the recyclables and sometimes even the solid waste will go through these facilities and they'll remove recyclables and market those and sell those off. Not all of our facilities have those, but I'm not sure if we know how many materials recovery facilities we have, but there's a few.
Yeah.
Mostly at our larger landfills.
Right. Okay. So I will just refer you to SB 1838, which is it's obviously a Senate bill, and that really requires diversion of organic waste from landfills. That took effect in 2022. I think there's varying compliance depending on the jurisdiction with how that's working out. But it's obviously a significant undertaking as it relates to release of methane gas, right? And that is, you know, a very powerful greenhouse gas. So, but generally, this is a complicated permit process. Like anything, there's lots of different entities that come into play when it comes to permitting this, and we have a piece of that and certainly try to collaborate with all of our folks together. So I know Dr. Wolf had a comment and Ms. Harlan also.
Yes, it's a little tangential, but to augment the conversation on recycling is that this year, CalRecycle, you know, have expanded their requirements with solid waste. I'll give you a specific example, is that starting this year, all wine bottles have to have the, you know, recycling refund of 10 cents for a 750 milliliter bottle. Likewise for box wine. So you will see starting with 2020, any bottling done in 2024, that you will have these recycled requirement, which is very significant if you think, you know, the whole state, how much glass is being used. So that's one. And then the increase of pickup sites. And a very important part of the legislation was to require some of the, and there was quite a bit of pushback from, you know, the stores where you buy the product, that they have to accept the recycled material too. So that's, I think that's one example of, you know, significant change. The other one is that all bottles produced in the state of California now have an increased mandatory requirement of recycled glass to be used. So there's no such thing anymore as what we call virgin glass. So it has to have a recycled component. So I think there's a lot of progress being made. You know, it's solid, so, you know, from a water quality impact, you know, it's minimal, but certainly it gets into the conversation about the amount of material that can be diverted from landfill. Thank you for, you know, the opportunity to share a little bit more information on that topic.
Thank you. Board Member Harlan.
The landfill in Marina has a wonderful store called Last Chance Mercantile. And you can go there, and they divert a lot of materials. And you can go in there and buy things at a very, very, very reasonable price. And it's also, if you're ever in this area and want to take a tour of it, they have a wonderful materials recovery facility and state-of-the-art everything. Their office building was built out of recycled automobile glass, their windows and so forth. The whole building was made out of recycled materials, and they won an award many years ago for the best landfill in the United States, I think. But I know the landfill in South Santa Cruz County at Buena Vista also does some diversion, and they have a small store. But that's really the wave of the future. But also, one thing that I would like to see more of are buyback centers, because people are just throwing up, they're paying for it, they're throwing it away, it's going into a big fund up in Sacramento, and if we had more buyback centers, I think that that would be really good for people. And I worked for a couple years up in Yosemite, and we had the employees up there all kept a recycled bag in their house and would put the stuff in there and bring it over to me in the village store to count them and give them the money. And that was just a routine thing. When I came back, I was just shocked that people just throw it away and you know, lose that money. It's too bad, because it's not a lot, but it's something. And it really gets the material where it needs to go, which is back into recycled. So, thanks.
Sounds like a site visit, Ms. Harlan. Thank you for the suggestion and the information. You're used to us, Mr. Fletcher. We tend to digress. I'm sorry. So anyway, back to you.
Okay. We've kind of discussed Class 3 facilities, but they represent most of the landfills we regulate, both from an open and closed position, and they manage municipal and dispose of municipal solid waste. The final category on here is unclassified, and that includes inert waste facilities. Inert waste is solid waste that does not contain hazardous waste, or significant soluble pollutants or significant quantities of decomposable waste. We do not have any standalone inert waste sites in our region. Many of our Class 3 landfills have accepted or managed inert waste in the past. And that doesn't always mean it goes to disposal Often it's reused, repurposed, either as landfill daily cover and such. We mentioned it, this picture is the Buena Vista landfill. One of the issues that we deal with there are neighbors with the Watsonville landfill, and birds are a very tough issue because when they use their controls, the birds just launch off and fly right over to the Watsonville landfill and back and forth.
Do they not have a falcon program
or
anything?
They do not. I have. I've encouraged it, but falcons can be expensive, and so it's a budget type decision.
So can complaints, though.
Oh, yes. And Cal Recycle typically is the lead for birds and the potential for migration of trash because they can come down and they pick up garbage.
Thank you.
Landfill facilities can impact groundwater and surface water from the discharge of leachate, landfill gas that contacts groundwater or surface water and impacted stormwater. Landfill leachate is a liquid generated from the existing moisture within landfill waste at the time of disposal and the percolation of water into the landfill during wet weather or dust control. Leachate from Class 3 landfill facilities typically contains high concentrations of total dissolved solids, chemical oxygen demand, and the pH can vary from slightly acidic or basic depending on the landfill's age. Class 3 landfill leachate also contains volatile and semi-volatile organic compounds and may contain heavy metals. Landfill gas is a natural byproduct of the decomposition of organic materials and is primarily composed of methane and carbon dioxide. It can also contain moisture and volatile organic compounds. Uncontrolled landfill gas can migrate beyond waste disposal areas to impact groundwater or surface water. Exposed waste or leachate seeps can impact stormwater. Landfill stormwater runoff can also contain waste such as plastic, which can be transported away from the disposal area due to wind, or other miscellaneous wastes from spills prior to disposal. Landfill stormwater can also be impacted by sediment if erosion or sediment controls are insufficient. The potential for water quality impacts from landfills facilities can be greatly reduced with proper design and construction and waste handling and disposal or diversion operations. Landfills are designed to minimize percolation of stormwater using covers, grading, and steep slopes. In the last several years, we have begun evaluating our landfills for potential impacts to groundwater and surface water from emerging contaminants, PFAS. Our PFAS efforts are discussed towards the end of this presentation. The Land Disposal Program uses a variety of regulatory tools to ensure compliance with state and federal requirements, including waste discharge requirements and enforcement tools, including 13267 orders, cleanup and abatement orders, cease and desist orders, notices to comply, and informal enforcement such as notices of violation. In general, as Ryan mentioned earlier, land disposal facilities are highly regulated facilities with owners and operators who have experience working with various regulatory agencies and typically work with land disposal staff to comply with all requirements. We also regularly coordinate and work with California Department of Resources, Recycling and Recovery, or CalRecycle, and their local enforcement agencies, which are typically local county environmental health departments, to ensure proper implementation of state requirements. CalRecycle and local enforcement agencies typically focus on operations, landfill gas, health and safety type issues, and financial assurance requirements. Less frequently, we will work with the California Air Board or their local pollution control districts on projects most often related to construction and dust type issues. Land disposal facilities must comply with prescriptive and federal design standards to ensure waste does not impact water quality. Engineered alternatives to prescriptive design standards are allowed, but must meet or outperform the performance standards of the prescriptive design. To protect water quality, landfills operate and maintain pollution control systems, including landfill covers, run-on-runoff diversion controls, landfill leachate and gas collection systems, and sometimes groundwater collection systems. For example, in this picture is a leachate collection tanks at the Santa Maria Regional Landfill. They have clear fill gauges marked on the outside of the tank, and you can see the secondary containment to contain leachate in the event of tank failure or overflow. Additionally, landfills are required to maintain financial assurance instruments to ensure adequate funds for closure, post-closure, and potential corrective action.
One question, please.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Where does the leachate go?
Most landfills try to reuse their leachate for dust control in the active area, in internal slopes, to make sure that it stays within the management unit. You then have evaporation, so you have a net reduction in overall moisture. As backup, most landfills have wastewater treatment plants listed, and I believe Santa Maria Landfill has that situation.
So the concept is trying to keep it as a closed system?
Yes, and you can imagine during the summer, that's relatively easy. During the winter, generation rates go up, sure, often depending on where they are at waste disposal in the module. If it's a relatively new module, that's a lot of potential infiltration. If there's not, it can take a while for it to affect.
Okay, thank you.
Every 5 years, landfill dischargers submit a joint technical document for review by both CalRecycle and the Water Board to provide updates on facility and operational changes. Closed landfill facilities are required to periodically survey their final covers for potential differential settlement, continue monitoring for water quality impacts, continue operating and managing pollution control systems to prevent water quality impacts, and maintain financial assurance for post-closure and potential corrective action. Post-closure maintenance is required for a minimum of 30 years after closure and until waste is no longer a threat to water quality, likely a high bar for large sites. This picture shows the Lewis Road closed landfill. This final cover includes a vegetative layer over what we call a geosynthetic clay liner.
Yes. Hi. Are there instances where other uses are made then of this land, such as, you know, solar panels or the like, and how effective has that been in terms of hopefully helping and not hurting water impacts on the closed landfill?
The typical use is open space for most of these landfills. However, we have facilities that have explored incorporating solar panels. Usually the barrier there is the connection fee and the infrastructure upgrades to be able to transport and distribute that solar to PG&E is very expensive. So we've had a couple facilities start to go down that route and then backpedal when they see PG&E's connection charges.
To add to that, generally it's pretty difficult to construct on top of a closed landfill due to settlement issues. So often kind of limited to things like parks, open spaces, like Martin said, or things that where settlement isn't a concern. And sometimes you do have gas coming off these landfills, which can cause odor concerns. So they can't be used for everything, but in general, there is an attempt to kind of utilize that space.
Oh, I just remember years ago, I did work for some time in New Jersey and live in New Jersey, and I believe there were some examples where early days of this where solar was being put over closed landfills or other types of waste sites. So it does seem like it's something, but it's not prohibited, you're just saying it's just very expensive.
Yes.
And maybe technically challenging.
Yep.
And yeah, it would be great if we could find a way to reuse this land, right?
Yeah, typically operators or owners can come to us with changes or proposed changes for land use, and then we would incorporate and work with them to require, say, for solar panels, a special mounting structure or something that works with the final cover and doesn't damage the final cover. But those are potentially complex issues. But there is nothing, like I said, they can approach us and we can work with them to address them.
Thank you. Ms. Harlan.
One example from the past was that Shoreview Amphitheater in Mountain View was built on a previous landfill, and when it first opened, there were odor issues, and they somehow fixed that. But it's a great place to go for a concert. I've been there many, many times, and it works. It was a big space, and it's used, and they got it done at that time, and very successful. Love to see more of those kind of things.
Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Are you going to talk about abandoned landfills at any with any detail?
I had not planned to.
Okay, then I got a question for you. So how does that occur? And once it's designated abandoned, who becomes responsible? Is it the state, or how does that work? And then what authority do we have over abandoned?
In my experience, the initial contact with regards to potentially abandoned landfills is usually at the local county environmental health level. Mm-hmm. And so they are working to clean up sites. Most of our abandoned landfills are older yeah. landfills, and ultimately we tend to have the county taking over as kind of the responsible party for maintaining or working with that area.
Are these landfills that were, imagine they're very small in scale, yeah. Would you see a landfill like that, say, on a large farm that has, you know, three generations of family living there? Is that the kind of situation where a private landfill would be developed or created?
With regards to most, like what we see is landfills that were often the official disposal areas for communities, and they have changed hands, and ultimately they are old. For newer sites, I do think that you have that potential with regards to large farms and having lots of animals and. Mm-hmm. And such that they may have not unpermitted disposal areas, but mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything come across my desk or within the unit.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll add a couple things to that as well. New landfills obviously have very strict financial assurance requirements, so if the entity that controls it was to go bankrupt, there'd still be bonds in place to fund the maintenance and corrective action for many years into the future mm-hmm. to prevent that from happening. In general, though, if something like a small farm we were to discover was dumping waste into a location and using it as an unpermitted landfill, they would be responsible. The landowner would be on the hook for remediating that and maybe either clean closure or ongoing monitoring of that site. The abandoned ones we see now are very historic at this point. I think many of were closed in the 50s, 60s, yeah. correct if I'm wrong.
So even though they served a community purpose, they were privately owned and operated, abandoned?
Not sure.
Yeah, it would vary. In some, just like we have private entities running landfills today. So
yeah,
there were private entities that provided their land and provided disposal for a community. Often for those older facilities, they're burn dumps. A lot of waste was burned, and so you have ash and such.
It would just seem to me, though, an abandoned landfill that was served as a community resource, if you will, that the county or the municipal government would still have to be responsible for it. So is that pretty much how it works?
Yeah. The Title 27 essentially makes those old facilities exempt from most of Title 27, but we can require corrective action and monitoring for those sites. I think that many of those old sites have essentially soil covers. They are, and then we look for potential land use problems to ensure that someone doesn't come and build something that's incompatible with what's there. And deed restrictions, those are all tools to ensure that people buying property know what's on the property.
Right. Okay, thank you. Okay. Helps me fill in the picture.
Mr. Lodge.
Well, we also have a closed, abandoned, and active order that covers those old facilities that are pre-Title 27.
The question is, though, in terms of post-closure and costs associated for any of that.
Right, yeah, it's usually the local, the county, in the counties that take on that responsibility.
And they're the entity we interact with.
Correct.
Right, yes. Okay, thank you.
Dr. Wolf, you had a question.
Yeah, just for Dr. Hunter, you know, on private properties, let's say farms, ranches, today, when there is a property being transferred and sold, there's a significant amount of vetting process, and there's a whole section on environmental disclosures because of the liabilities of acquiring a property and then finding out there used to be, you know, private landfills. So today's an age, it goes under magnifying glasses, and it's actually, you know, perjury if you're going to sell and not disclose what you know of the past. So I would say, you know, going forward with real estate transactions, that's, you know, that's quite a rigorous process.
Not everybody exercises extensive due diligence, though. I think that there's certainly cases where people do not dig into the details. And, I mean, I've, on my job side, handled folks who are not extending, you know, due diligence. So it's certainly something one needs to exercise.
But it's in... the legal form.
I understand, but not everyone does the due diligence when they're acquiring property.
But that's then violating.
Can I also interject for a moment? The other issue is with abandoned sites is that if they do pose a threat to water quality or public health, we also have the cleanup and abatement approach, and then we would just name the landowner, and if we have records of who could potentially have discharge the waste, adding them to the cleanup and abatement order. Most of the abandoned ones, though, are burn dumps, and they don't usually typically pose a significant threat to our quality. So it just falls on the very low on our big workload. And so.
Modern landfills are engineered systems designed to keep waste in place and isolated from the environment. Shown on the slide is an example of a simplified, modified landfill cross-section. Landfill operators are required to install new liners for all new landfill modules. The liner is shown in dark gray and typically consists of a base liner and a slope liner. The leachate collection system is shown in light gray above the liner and often includes a sump to maximize or to minimize leachate buildup over the liner and help with removal. Not shown in the cross-section, but common to modern landfills is a leak detection lysimeter or a layer below the sump or significant leachate collection areas. Landfill gas collection wells in the cross-section are shown placed in the final cover area, but are typically installed as waste is placed and continue to be extended as waste is placed. Landfill gas collection is intended to prevent buildup and migration of that landfill gas to ensure public safety and prevent impacts to water quality. During landfill's operational life, daily and intermediate covers are used to contain waste from the environment and reduce the infiltration of water into the landfill during wet weather. Once final elevations are reached, an engineered final cover is constructed. The landfill cross-section also includes landfill gas probes, groundwater monitoring wells, which are located around the landfill and down gradient as necessary. What's important to note is active landfills are constantly under construction with numerous permanent and temporary features. Usually it is a temporary or a new feature, such as grading or slopes and drainages that can result in problems, usually during wet weather.
Yeah, Anne.
Sorry, back on that photo. You showed the landfill gas backup flare. Mm-hmm. How much of the gas is flared versus, I also see you have the landfill gas to energy. I mean, how much of the gas are we able to collect on and divert or utilize?
Okay. It's a complex issue for landfill operators because typically the landfill gas generator what we call cogen facilities, are operated by a different entity, and they want good landfill gas to produce power. And so there is a situation where they sometimes turn off their systems to help the landfill build up good gas before they want to pull and generate power. We are looking at it from a water quality standpoint, and the owners don't want to have water quality issues. And so typically they try to use a flare as both backup for when the facility is not working, but also if you're going to shut off your power facility, we're just going to run our flare. And but I would say at most facilities that have power generation, they are trying to maximize the amount that they are generating from that landfill gas. Yeah. These are photos of a liner system installation at the city of Watsonville landfill. The photo on the left shows three stages of what we call an encapsulated geosynthetic clay slope liner. The black material on the right of the photo is the lower 40 millimeter high density polyethylene, or HDPE, membrane. The gray material on the left of the photo is the geosynthetic clay liner, or GCL, which is a relatively thin layer of processed clay fixed between two geotextiles. And the white material in the middle of the photo on the slope is the upper 60 millimeter HDPE membrane. The reason you see it in that order is you would have the lower membrane installed. You then install the GCL layer and must cover it by the end of the day with the upper layer. So you can see how they have some exposed GCL, but by the end of the day, that white section of upper layer will fully encapsulate the GCL. And the reason for that is that geosynthetic clay liner is extremely aggressive to pull moisture. So if you leave it open to the environment, it will pull moisture out of the air. It's that aggressive. So the base liner for this module will also be encapsulated GCL design, but with the addition of a low permeable heavily compacted subgrade. The photo on the right shows the future leachate collection sump area, where a lysimeter will also be installed over the low perm subgrade for leak detection of the encapsulated GCL liner. Land disposal staff conduct multiple site inspections during liner installation. Liners will be covered by a protective soil layer prior to waste being placed, and preferential soft wastes are usually placed as the first lift to help protect that liner. Once waste is placed, there is a limited opportunity to address improperly installed or damaged liner. And it's important to note, we also have construction quality assurance. We require an independent third-party CQA on-site during the whole construction to ensure that it is both built to specifications and that there's no damage.
So I have a question on the liner. I mean, is there any sort of PFAS associated with the liners themselves, and how are we going to deal with that?
Yeah. We're very early. We've asked our landfills to look at potential sources for PFAS. Since I think we have found PFAS in various geomaterials. And typically there's a reason why they've used PFAS. PFAS has typically provided a lot of improvements to the products that we use in groundwater monitoring wells. For example, we know that we have the pumps. The most expensive pumps used to be the ones that had essentially PFAS in them because they lasted longer. So
I know that there was federal regulation related to AFFF, the foaming agent for fire extinguishers. So is there a similar process underway for things like this when we know that they're going to have deleterious impacts in the long run?
One of the things to note is our liners have to be have at least 5 foot separation from groundwater. They are installed, as you can see, in a situation where if they were to find groundwater seeps, they would be engineered with drainages to keep that separation from the liner. So at least from a liner perspective, there should be a very limited mobilization of any type of contaminants off a liner, because we they're designed in a manner not to be near groundwater, and then you're also cutting off the recharge. There's no recharge to move through that area.
Yeah. So to add to that, essentially, the PFAS, they're there may well be PFAS in it, but conceptually it should be pretty locked, hopefully is pretty locked in there, but we're still in the process of investigating to what extent there is PFAS and how, if at all, that it might contribute to groundwater impacts.
Thanks, I appreciate that. Conceptually and reality are not always aligned, so I appreciate that, Mr.
Yeah, and I think the threat, we have found that there's a pretty good amount of PFAS in landfill leachate, so I think the threat from that leachate getting to groundwater is a lot greater than what might be in the liner material itself. And to Martin's point, there's a lot less threat and that there's going to be groundwater touching that bottom part of that liner as the facility operates.
But Dr. Wolf, yeah.
Thank you. That gets back to my question earlier. I didn't want to use a P word when I said closed system. Because, you know, when we looked at the tanks, I'm like, okay, you're going to be testing that water. And if it has a certain amount of contaminants in it, you know, if you have a closed system, it stays within. And then you mentioned the option of being able to take it offsite. But that's a different topic, because when you take it offsite, what are you going to do with it, right? Because that technology is not quite there yet with water treatment facilities on how to manage the PFAS. So. It's kind of an interesting topic, though.
It is, and I notice, this is a tangential observation, but we're all very quiet during this topic, as if us talking about it quietly is somehow going to be safer, but it's a concern. It's a big concern. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had something you wanted to say, Mr. Lodge.
Yeah, it's very complex because, you know, those wastewater treatment plants produce biosolids that may have PFAS in them as well, and they want to dispose of those biosolids, often at landfills, and then there you get the added complication of needing to divert organics from those landfills, and those biosolids need to go somewhere. So it's a very complex situation when it comes to PFAS and our waste streams and how they combine in different programs. And so we're working on that, not only at the Central Coast region, but at statewide to try to figure out the best approach.
I mean, we did have a briefing, I think it was at WQCC, on sort of the PFAS issue a number of years ago and the global compliance efforts, but as yet we don't have any sort of global compliance and regulation because we have to, it's a source control issue. So, yeah, it's very overwhelming. Always, yes. Yes.
I was just on a slightly other topic. I was part of a committee here in Santa Cruz County that looked for a location for another landfill so that when this one is filled up, we would have another site. So we spent a couple years of leaving your politics at the door. Look at maps. And needed 100 acres of land that didn't have any constraints or earthquake faults, et cetera. And it was practically impossible, except for farmland down in Watsonville that would have to be rezoned, of course. And people down there didn't want it. And so we ended up just continuing with our program with the Marina landfill, and they had space to expand, and so they said, you're going to be good for a while, but it's an issue that also is going to face communities in the future that they are going to fill up, they are going to close, they are going to need another location, and that it's very complicated. It's very interesting, though, to look at that.
Yeah, I think that gets back to Board Member Hoskins' point about utilization and reuse of these. But again, these are fairly remote locations. So co-locating, let's say, a solar facility, if there isn't a transmission hub close to it, becomes another cost-intensive endeavor. So yeah, these are very complicated issues. Back to your presentation.
Seems like we're having technical difficulties with our remote. Give us 1 minute here.
Land disposal program staff also review final cover designs to ensure compliance with state and federal requirements. And similar to liner construction, we make it a priority to conduct inspections during final cover construction. The prescriptive standard for a cover includes a clay component. However, most covers are approved engineered alternatives. The photo on the left is the Crazy Horse closed landfill, and it is a synthetic turf over a geomembrane. For board members that might have been part of that We used the closure, the synthetic turf was used because it was an alternative to trucking in more than 2 feet of soil over 70 acres. So for the environmental cost of trucking all that soil in, potentially from a different community, it made sense to look at the synthetic turf. And speaking to the solar panels, this was a site that was originally slated to get solar panels. I still ask about it, but I'm not sure where that is now. The picture on the right is from the Ben Lomond closed landfill, and it shows a final cover with a vegetative soil over a geomembrane and clay on the top deck, and a vegetative soil over just clay on the side slopes. And often you see different designs for top decks and slopes because there's a different amount of water that's potentially going to infiltrate. Some of our closed landfills have evapotranspiration soil covers that are often 4 to 5 feet thick with specific soil characteristics to retain water for vegetation and minimize infiltration into the landfill. Despite their differences, final covers are designed to shed water and prevent moisture from contacting waste. We currently regulate 10 compost facilities in the region. 9 are covered by the statewide general compost order. The statewide compost order was issued in 2015 and updated in 2020. One facility we have is covered by their site-specific landfill order, but will be enrolled in the general compost order. We expect to see more compost facilities and expansion of existing facilities due to the state mandate on organic diversion, as previously mentioned, State Bill 1383. And that requires 75% diversion by 2025. The compost general order requires low permeability working surfaces and lined basins to collect runoff. Water that contacts compost or feedstocks is considered wastewater and must be treated as such. Compost wastewater is typically high in total dissolved solids, low in dissolved oxygen, high in nutrients, and can contain metals or other constituents depending on feedstocks or additives. Most sites use lined basins, but a few sites utilize tanks to collect the water. The two photos on the left are from the Johnson Canyon Landfill compost facility. You can see the compacted work deck. And then the two photos on the right are from the Recology Pacheco Pass compost facility, and they both have lined ponds and tanks to handle wastewater, and it's reused typically in the compost process. The land disposal program's priorities and goals are focused on protecting water quality. In recent years, we have been focused on improving program efficiency with the development of general orders to create up-to-date and consistent regulatory requirements for similar landfill facilities. Since the adoption of our general waste discharge requirements for active Class 3 landfills in 2020, which was first in the state, we have enrolled all applicable facilities and updated their monitoring reporting programs, except for one, the Lust Forest Landfill, which has not been constructed and is currently undergoing redesign and will require environmental review. We anticipate enrolling the Lust Forest Landfill into the general active order once it's redesigned and environmental review is complete and we receive an updated joint technical document. Up for consideration today by the board is our general order for closed landfills. Development of the general order for closed landfills is an extension of our efforts to prioritize program efficiency. Nick Smara will be presenting the general order for your consideration following this landfill program update. With limited staff resources, the land disposal program prioritizes review and approval of design reports for liners and final covers and conducting inspections during those construction of projects. We also prioritize wet weather preparedness reports and conduct inspections pre-wet weather, during wet weather, or after wet weather as appropriate. This last fiscal year, we had approximately 9 landfills in various stages of design, planning, or construction. And most of our inspections were related to construction or wet weather. We also review monitoring reports with a focus on groundwater quality to evaluate impacts from the facilities. PFAS is an emerging contaminant of concern at our landfills. We are preparing to evaluate PFAS data and potential receptors at our landfills. The status of our PFAS efforts is discussed on the next slide. The upper photo in this picture is a slope line of construction at the Johnson Canyon landfill, a relatively large facility. You can see the upper white layer is the upper membrane. The white is the GCL and the black is the membrane. And as I mentioned before, by the end of the day, on whatever construction day, they will have that covered with membrane. The lower two photos show some wet weather preparedness actions at the Pacheco Pass landfill. That is a stormwater basin that has been cleaned out and is ready to receive water. And then you have a down drain that has some filtration to help reduce sediment loading to that retention basin. A lot of our landfills are old, and they are limited by the size and constraints for those sediment retention ponds. So even though they have sediment retention ponds, they often have to be aggressive to try to reduce that sediment load because they can't expand the pond very easily. It's limited. And as the landfill gets bigger, the amount of water passing through that basin increases.
Dr. Hunter.
Just a quick question, I'm hoping. Those bottom two photos show two examples of something, and can you tell us more about it? And the one on the left in particular, I see some dark stripes going across that path or road, and then a receptor or vertical pipe with a hose coming out of it. Can you tell me what those are?
Yeah. So for low flows, the stripes are some type of filtration retention, so that each one of those sections will retain some of the sediments, and then it will get down to the standpipe, which likely does not discharge until it hits the top of that standpipe. So there is a retention capacity, and then also it tends to pull the discharged stormwater from the surface, allowing for any sediment that's settling to stay in the pond. The down drain, that's a down drain actually not too far away from this sediment retention pond. And again, like I said, it's designed to try to capture some of the sediment in there and would require regular clean out during the season. So following storms, they might clean the area around that to restore capacity.
Where is the drain? What is the drain connected to?
For the storm sediment retention basin?
Yeah.
Likely the seasonal creek that runs. I mean, most landfills are constructed in canyons. Mm-hmm. So you have some natural water body, you know, that applies. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm still confused. So a drain is constructed in an area designed to collect sediment and minimize that problem, but it's the rainwater.
Yeah, so this is
draining.
This is stormwater. For Pacheco, they have a fully closed landfill, mm-hmm. and they have a compost facility. Mm-hmm. The compost facility area drains to the lined ponds that I think you saw in the previous mm-hmm. picture, mm-hmm. And the tanks. The closed landfill, which is all soil covers at this point, mm-hmm. Drains through this infrastructure here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
In 2019, the State Water Board issued Water Code Section 13267 orders for the determination of the presence of PFAS at our active landfills. Data from the sampling events indicated that all landfill leachate sampled contained PFAS, and some groundwater wells, typically downgrading of old unlined waste disposal areas, had low-level PFAS detections in groundwater. Based on the initial PFAS sampling data, the Central Coast Water Board issued 13267 orders in July 2021, requiring active landfill operators to submit a follow-up PFAS work plan. The follow-up work plans included semi-annual monitoring for 2 years for 31 PFAS analytes, provided a plan to identify potential sources of PFAS, provided a leachate management plan, and provided a plan to identify potential downgrading receptors, including notification of those property owners if PFAS impacts threaten to impact supply wells. The land disposal program anticipates that the majority of active landfills will complete their follow-up work plan monitoring in 2024, with final reports submitted shortly thereafter. As previously mentioned, up for consideration today by the board is the general WDR for closed landfills, which includes regular PFAS monitoring. The land disposal program anticipates that active landfill monitoring and reporting programs will also be updated to include PFAS monitoring within the next several years, depending on enrollment of the closed facilities in the general WDR and evaluation of the monitoring data from the follow-up work plans. It is important to note that the Central Coast region is ahead of all other regions with our follow-up work plans and required monitoring in our PFAS PFAS monitoring in the general WDR for closed landfills. We believe it is most appropriate to prioritize monitoring for PFAS while working with dischargers to protect critical receptors. And we understand that our ability to monitor for, knowledge of, and feasible corrective actions for PFAS are developing and rapidly evolving.
Are there any other, thank you, Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Sisk. Do we have any questions or comments on that? Okay. Yes, Mr. Rodriguez.
I have a handful of questions very quickly here. My first one is regarding cannabis waste. Cannabis waste is an organic waste, but I know it's treated differently because of both federal and state issues. How is that disposed of? What classification of landfill does it go into, or is it considered organic waste like the food scraps when it's for its disposal?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I don't know if Ryan, Taya, if either of you know either, but
I stumped you guys.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure on that. I'm assuming it'd be classified to see if it's hazardous or not, and then would be treated accordingly. But
yeah, I'm not sure if it would be hazardous. There are special provisions for how they handle that waste or who can handle that waste, because we did get inquiries at some landfills whether they could accept that, but I don't know for sure how they're managing it, and it's an organic, so it would need to be diverted, but they do need to be careful about how they manage that material.
And my follow-up tangential question is illegal grows, illegal operations, right? Those are typically burned by the State Department of Justice, and I know that they've considered doing other things with it. And again, I guess that's more of a general statement than anything. Another question that I have going, and you don't have to pull the slide up, but on slide 10, regarding required ongoing monitoring, what typically is the length? I'm assuming it's dependent on what's being disposed of in the landfill or the size of the landfill, I would imagine.
Yeah, most of our landfills that are regulated with our closure WDRs have very similar monitoring to our active landfills. It just continues. They still have to monitor semi-annually. And they have to do their constituents of concern monitoring every 5 years, which is more extensive. And so the monitoring requirements are very similar.
And that will go on for a minimum of 30 years or until it's deemed to not be a threat. And most landfills, this probably will be beyond 30 years, but it'll depend on the situation, case by case.
And, another question, I'm assuming this is a cost consideration, is why isn't concrete used to line they use it for nuclear waste, and I would imagine it would help with seepage, but again, the cost of it would be phenomenal, I would imagine, especially that landfill on the last photo you showed.
Yeah, I think it would be important to note that it's likely not just concrete, that it will
yes.
It will have concrete and membranes and such. And when we design a liner, there's a certain level of, compaction that is done to create a benefit for, to protect that liner and prevent settlement. So the liner still provides the primary barrier, and concrete tends to be permeable too. I mean, and so we've seen that in old concrete ponds that are used to be used. And so, like I said, there's usually a there's usually a membrane, and the membrane is actually the primary barrier. The concrete would be the protection around the membrane.
And again, the assumption on my end is a cost benefit analysis of it.
Yeah, I would assume that's the primary driving factor.
On slide 14, you talked about SB 1383, and I've followed it, not closely, but I have followed it, and I know that there were some hearings that the Little Hoover Commission did a few months ago, and the waste management companies are having a fit over it because of, again, costs, mm-hmm. and you know, how do they pass that on? Is there anything you can share about that above what you did already in the presentation?
Yeah, you know, with any, and this isn't just organics, diversion is expensive, and typically when we show up for, say, wet weather inspections, we hope that their piles are smaller because we're going into the wet weather season. Often landfills will be looking for the opportunity to sell their recyclables, you know, for, and so they're waiting for a cost, you know, as something that makes it worthwhile. We tend to approach, again, from a water quality perspective. So while we support all the diversion efforts, we also want to make sure that we don't have a water quality issue. Yeah. And but yes, landfill operators are struggling to meet those diversion numbers, and it's also education of the public is also one of those issues. We see different waste streams coming in with different problems from different communities, and that often goes to how well they're educating and the capability for those communities to separate.
And my final question is, and I don't know if you have this, but a guess would be good, is what percentage of new landfills are using workable ag land versus land that can't be used? You know, that's not...
The most specific example is the Lewis Forest landfill that was permitted in 2014. There's not very many new permitted facilities.
I'm sorry, could you just speak a little, or could you just move the mic a little closer?
Sorry about that. An example would be the Lewis Forest landfill as a recently permitted facility. That is old oil field property, and it actually went through the environmental review process much easier than what you would anticipate for a landfill because of that. It is the oil field property that has actually caused the design changes. So with regards to existing landfills, they typically already have a plan for their property, and in many cases they are surrounded by ag land. And that also provides a little bit of a buffer from having residences and such.
Thank you very much. Great presentation.
Questions or comments from my board colleagues? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Sisk.
The Central Coast Water Board has identified high priority issues to be considered for both board and staff actions. The land disposal program priorities are consistent with the Central Coast region's human right to water resolution because our regulatory efforts prioritize waste containment and protecting groundwater and surface water that serves as sources of drinking water. Water Board staff, in advance of proposed individual and general WDRs, reach out to underrepresented communities, California tribes, and neighbors within approximately a half mile of applicable facilities during the formal review process to ensure they have an opportunity to understand and provide input or comment. Lastly, the Central Coast Water Board prioritizes actions that address climate change adaptation and mitigation strategies. More frequent and high-intensity storms may result in damage to landfill covers and drainage facilities. Our WDRs require to be able to manage, at a minimum, 100-year 24-hour storms, to submit and implement annual wet weather preparedness plans, and to inspect landfills after large storm events. Due to climate change, land disposal program staff recognize that the design values may trend higher and may require landfills to upgrade drainage infrastructure.
I had a question on the number and experience of landfill operators that are out there. When you have, I mean, do you see sort of a clustering in the market of certain entities in our region operating and maintaining and managing these?
Well, city, county operators, and then we have a few private facilities, and they each have their own challenges.
But yeah, I think mostly municipal government entities, and then I mean maybe two or three different private entities, but they're mostly large entities, some of which are nationwide that operate the private ones.
Thank you.
The Central Coast Water Board's Land Disposal Program regulates landfills, surface impoundments, and other land disposal operations, including compost facilities, to ensure wastes contained in these facilities do not impact surface or groundwater. We will continue to evaluate our work through human right to water, environmental justice, and climate change lenses in an effort to identify and implement strategies that effectively address these important issues. Thank you for the opportunity to update the board on the Land Disposal Program, and this concludes my presentation.
Really appreciate the very thorough presentation. Thank you, and really appreciate you allowing us to pepper you with questions as usual. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to apologize for asking all my questions on before you guys were done. I was trying to wait for the last slide. Thank you.
All good.
Yes. Just one last bit, since you know you said we're peppering, but it's kind of spice
or
up
salty,
the conversation,
whatever.
You know. So I'll spice it up a little more. I think some nice trends, particularly with compost, are facilities pursuing organic certification. Because a lot of people say, compost, it's organic. But organic certification is a whole different process with compost quality. And that is becoming very important because, particularly in the farming communities, the hesitance of, you know, bringing tons, we're not talking bags, but tons of compost and what's the content. So the certification program is pretty rigorous. And I think that's another positive trend in the market. Just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to request that we take a break, but before that, I believe we had 13 people on the webcast last time we checked, and then maybe when we come back from break, we can get another update. So it's 10:32. We will take a 15-minute break. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. The item on the agenda that we're going to be reviewing today now is consideration of proposed order R3-2024-0036. Mr. Lodge?
Yes, thank you, Chair Gray. Item 14 is for the board to consider proposed general waste discharge requirements for the closed landfill facilities in the Central Coast region. These general waste discharge requirements will replace 10 individual waste discharge requirements to regulate the post-closure maintenance and monitoring at closed landfill facilities. In 2020, the board adopted similar general waste discharge requirements for active landfills. The proposed general order, general waste discharge requirements will streamline the process for permitting closed landfill facilities. There is a supplemental sheet for this item to address a minor typographical error on page 8 of the proposed general waste discharge requirements. And we have Nick Smyra, engineering geologist in the land disposal program, here to present item 14. And again, sitting next to him is Joey Sisk, the land disposal program manager.
There you go. Let's try that again.
Yeah, it's on. It's great. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Gray and members of the board. My name is Nick Smyra, and I'm an engineering geologist in the Land Disposal Unit. You just heard from Martin during the Land Disposal Program update discuss the benefits of the active landfill general order and how it's been successfully implemented. Based on the success of that order, Central Coast Water Board staff have prepared general waste discharge requirements for closed landfills within the Central Coast region. Today I will be presenting on and recommending for adoption that proposed general order. Is my presentation up?
We're fine waiting. No worries. It's all good.
All right. Sorry about that. I'm going to start today's presentation with a brief discussion on closed landfills and why we are recommending a general order, followed by details on post-closure maintenance requirements, potential water quality impacts, and water quality protection measures. I'll then discuss the new PFAS monitoring requirements and provide an overview of the public comments we received and our responses to those comments. And lastly, I'll provide a summary of the actions available to the board and our recommendation. I'd also like to point out and call attention to the supplemental sheet, as Ryan Lodge did, and notify you that it was for provision 12, and we are recommending that a duplicate in that provision be removed. We currently regulate 10 closed landfills in the region with individual waste discharge requirements, or WDRs. These individual WDRs were adopted between 1997 and 2013. If adopted, the proposed general order will update the requirements for all 10 of these facilities and replace the older WDRs through one board action. As shown here, the closed landfills that will be covered under the proposed general order include facilities in 5 different counties within our region. Additionally, we anticipate that over the next few years to a decade, a few currently active landfills will be reaching their end of life and will be enrolled in the proposed general order following closure. Generally, operators of closed landfills listed here have a good record of compliance. Water Board staff have worked together with these operators to ensure measures are implemented to protect water quality and any issues were quickly addressed. A landfill is considered closed once a disposal of waste has stopped, a final cover has been installed, and the executive officer has approved the construction quality assurance report certifying the final cover. The closed landfills shown here on this figure and included on the previous table are closed Class 3 landfills that disposed of non-hazardous and municipal solid waste per California Code of Regulations Title 27 and the Code of Federal Regulations Part 258. However, future enrollments may include Class 2 landfills, such as the Chevron Guadalupe landfill following closure, or waste pile or surface impoundments that are closed as landfills in accordance with Title 27. Due to the prescriptive nature of the state and federal regulations and the similarity between closed landfill operations, these facilities are well suited for a general order. The benefits of a general order include updated and consistent requirements for landfill operators and improved efficiencies for staff. Moving from individual WDRs to a general order will allow staff to focus on high priority tasks such as liner and final cover review design reviews, inspections, water quality data analysis, and the implementation of corrective action programs. Additionally, the proposed general order will provide a streamlined permitting process for currently active landfills that are nearing their end of life and will be transitioning to a closed facility. This proposed general order will regulate the post-closure maintenance activities at closed landfills. This includes activities such as maintaining the structural integrity of the final cover system, monitoring settlement and ensuring positive drainage, and maintaining stormwater drainage systems and monitoring devices. The photo on the left shows an example of an evapotranspiration final cover at a closed landfill. The final cover here also includes concrete line drainage ditches to manage stormwater and benching along the slopes to minimize the potential for erosion. The proposed general order also requires water quality and landfill gas monitoring in accordance with Title 27. The photo on the right shows a landfill gas extraction well, while the photo in the center shows a groundwater monitoring well. This general order requires the implementation of corrective action programs whenever a release from a closed landfill facility adversely impacts water quality. While corrective action remedies will be site-specific, all corrective action programs must thoroughly characterize the nature and extent of the release, identify potential receptors, and provide timely notice to any potentially affected party. If impacted, water supply wells, if impacted water supply wells are identified, the corrective action program would be required to address the impacted supply wells with supplemental monitoring and wellhead treatment or replacement drinking water.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do we have any areas where replacement water is being given due to these leachate and other sort of problems that we're having adjacent to landfills?
Yeah, I believe we have at least one, and Ryan, you might be able to name the facility, but there's one in Salinas that has a replacement water related to VOC impacts down gradient.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with the Salinas one. I am familiar with Ballard Canyon.
The
county of Santa Barbara provides replacement water for residents down gradient from Ballard Canyon. They installed a separate system. I'm not sure about the Salinas facility, if there's another one, but I do know that Ballard is an example.
I think that's
our only one.
Yeah, maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, board member.
How many homeowners does that affect?
Offhand, I do not know. Ryan, do you happen to know?
Yeah, I don't recall. It was maybe a dozen.
It's a really small community.
Yeah, large parcels, maybe not even a dozen, maybe half a dozen.
And it's not an environmental justice community by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
So it's a very small group of people. Thank you very much.
As Martin described on the last item, landfills can impact groundwater and surface water from discharges of landfill leachate, landfill gas that contacts groundwater, and impacted stormwater. Generally speaking, these closed landfills present less of a risk to water quality, and this is because the final cover systems are designed to keep liquids out of the landfill and thereby reducing the generation of landfill leachate and landfill gas. However, these sources of contamination are still present at closed landfills and need to be managed to ensure protection of water quality. The proposed general order also includes measures to manage and monitor stormwater. While closed landfills generally pose a low threat to stormwater quality, the historic use of landfill leachate for dust control or the operation of a transfer station may result in stormwater impacts. In some cases, these closed landfills are still required to comply with the statewide general industrial stormwater permit. The potential for water quality impacts from closed landfills can be greatly reduced with proper post-closure maintenance. The primary objective in post-closure period is to protect and maintain the structural integrity and effectiveness of all containment structures, stormwater conveyance systems, leachate and landfill gas collection systems, and monitoring systems. To accomplish this objective, this general order requires visual inspections, periodic leak searches, and the collection of analytical data to confirm that the closed landfill is not adversely impacting water quality. The photograph here illustrates what a closed landfill with adequate post-closure maintenance may look like. The vegetative cover appears healthy. The final cover is graded to direct stormwater to the stormwater conveyance features, and there are no signs of slope erosion or settlement that may result in ponding. This general order requires that closed landfills also maintain financial assurance and implement corrective action programs in the event of a documented release in accordance with Title 27.
I have a question.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. A question. I might be asking you in the wrong point in your presentation, so you can let me know. But with older landfills that don't have these protective construction and liners, Do the monitoring wells then determine what the leachate is, the volume, and what contaminants might be in there? And if they are showing, and I'm guessing they would, show contaminant in the leachate, what is the action that's taken below the closed landfill?
Yeah, so the majority of these facilities are going to be either unlined or contain some unlined components. Mm-hmm. So there's not leachate collection in that case. So impacts to groundwater are determined based on the groundwater detection monitoring programs.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of their responsibility?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And Title 27 requires detection monitoring at the downgradient edge mm-hmm. of the waste management unit at mm-hmm. first encounter groundwater. So that's the point of compliance, mm-hmm. and that's what we'll use in those cases where there isn't, leachate. I mean, that's what we use in all cases, but when there's not yeah. leachate collection,
right.
that's our best place to look to see if there's impacts as a result of a leachate discharge.
So if it's showing a major contamination in those monitoring down slope mm-hmm. monitoring wells, what can be done?
So Title 27 requires if there's a detection at that downgradient monitoring point that they first go into what's called evaluation monitoring, mm-hmm. and they determine the extent of the release as well as all the constituents that could be potentially identified and harmful. And then they're required to implement a corrective action program. In a lot of the cases, because they're rural facilities, the corrective action program could look as simple as a continued monitoring of natural attenuation of the constituents and making sure that downgradient receptors aren't impacted. Mm-hmm. In other cases, they may install like a pump and treat system where they extract groundwater and send it through treatment. So it's really site-specific what's done.
Right. That's what I was looking for, pump and treat. Thank you. Okay, good to know.
Could I add one thing? A lot of times we have small detections of VOCs downgradient, and a lot of times that's gas-related. And so sometimes another alternative corrective action is to install additional gas extraction systems with extraction wells to pull the gas. And that's been really shown to be effective. Or adding more soil to the cover, or finding if there's maybe a crack somewhere where water's getting into. And those are very common maintenance activities that can resolve downgradient concentrations.
The requirements for post-closure maintenance at closed landfills under the proposed general order are largely the same as the requirements that were included in individual waste discharge requirements. However, there are some significant improvements to the water quality monitoring requirements under the proposed general order. To implement these changes, individual monitoring and reporting programs, or MRPs, will be issued to each facility. Individual MRPs will be issued based on the general MRP that's included as Attachment A to the proposed general order, but will be tailored to meet the site-specific conditions. Operators will also have an opportunity to provide input during this process. The updated individual MRPs will allow staff to more thoroughly evaluate water chemistry and guide decision-making, and also evaluate emerging contaminants, some of which have recently been issued federal maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, by the US EPA. This will be done through requiring consistent monitoring parameters between leachate, groundwater, and surface water, and in some cases, stormwater, by analyzing general minerals to develop Piper and Stiff diagrams to improve groundwater source identification, and by requiring 2 years of semi-annual PFAS monitoring to evaluate the presence or absence of PFAS. If PFAS is detected and determined to be caused by a release from the landfill, corrective action measures will be required. If a release of PFAS has not been detected after the first two semi-annual years of monitoring, the sampling frequency will be reduced. The draft general order was circulated for a formal 30-day public comment period in May of 2024. Central Coast Water Board staff sent the notice of public hearing and a draft general order to an extensive list of stakeholders. The notice of public hearing expressed our intent to consider adoption of the proposed general order and notified these parties of their opportunity to submit written comments. Three comment letters were submitted, and no other comments, written or otherwise, were received.
We have one question, please.
Oh, yes.
So before we dive into the public comments, the impact of climate change on closure, can you speak to about that a little bit? One obvious, you know, the obvious is storm events being significantly different than when these facilities were first designed. So that's part one. And then the other one, when I was looking at this beautiful picture of nice green grass, which is kind of an optimistic look for California, you know, when this grass dries, I assume there's some maintenance of mowing, because you don't want to end up with a lot of fire fuels. So that's the other thought, is, you know, the impact of having, you know, dry grass if you do not maintain properly vegetated cover. So can you speak a little bit about how we tackled climate change in this particular instance?
Yeah. So as you noted, most of these facilities, especially the 10 that are identified here, are already constructed with a final cover system.
Right.
You know, as time goes on, as we continue to have larger storm events, we may need to update the stormwater containment features at some of these facilities, but that'd be handled on a site-by-site basis. As far as the vegetative covers and maintaining vegetation, these facilities tend to require native grasses. They work quite hard at trying to keep these seed mixtures to be native. But yeah, they do require maintenance, and mowing is part of that.
The grass, you know, as it dries out and dies during the summer, actually isn't necessarily an issue, because we want the vegetation there, particularly during the winter, to prevent erosion when it begins to regrow. So.
No, I'm not.
Okay, just the clarification.
I'm not suggesting Roundup here.
Okay, yeah.
To be clear.
Well, some of these facilities kind of have, I wouldn't say natural fire breaks, but they're benched, and a lot of times there's drainage features on the benches, so that they do kind of get broken up a little bit, and there's roads along the perimeters of some of these facilities. But that is a concern. I mean, we have had some facilities like the Tahigas landfill that were subject to a fire that came through. And it's a balance between keeping the vegetative cover so you can keep the soil on the cover and not having too much.
Yeah. And my my question on climate change was aimed primarily at these, you know, stormwater capturing. You know, but I thought, okay, we need to look also at possibilities of fires, as you gave that specific example. So thank you for the clarification.
As stated on the previous slide, staff received three comment letters during the comment period. The comment letters were submitted by closed landfill operators and were largely focused on the PFAS monitoring requirements of the proposed general order. The comments and staff's responses are included in attachment 2 to the staff report. Given that many of the comments we received were focused on PFAS, it's important to articulate why PFAS monitoring is necessary. First off, PFAS detections in groundwater have been documented down gradient unlined waste management units at active landfills in Region 3. Many of the closed landfills that will be enrolled under the proposed general order are unlined or include some modules that are unlined. It's reasonable to assume that we may encounter PFAS impacts down gradient these unlined waste management units at closed landfills. Secondly, given the low detection limits for PFAS, the potential for cross-contamination during sampling, and the possibility of background sources, 2 years of semi-annual monitoring will provide staff with the minimum information necessary to make these evaluations. Lastly, exposure to PFAS can cause serious health problems and was recently issued federal MCLs by the US EPA. And therefore, the PFAS monitoring requirements of this general order are necessary for the protection of human health and water quality. Staff identified three general comment areas, all of which were related to PFAS. The first of these concerns were related to the increased costs. Water Board staff considered these costs, but ultimately chose not to modify the monitoring requirements of the proposed general order. The cost of compliance, including the PFAS monitoring component, was evaluated and presented as a finding in the proposed general order. Staff found that these costs were reasonable because the data are needed to evaluate compliance with the proposed order. And these data also support the protection of human health, water quality, and confirms that beneficial uses are being protected. If PFAS is not detected, the sampling and analysis costs significantly decrease after the first 2 years. Additionally, operators will have an opportunity to provide data and recommendations during the development of individual MRPs that may result in further cost reductions for those operators. Water Board staff did not evaluate the cost of a hypothetical corrective action program because those corrective action programs are highly variable. If corrective action programs are required to address PFAS releases, the Central Coast Water Board staff will work with the dischargers to develop a program that's both protective of water quality and reasonable. The second general comment concerns how Water Board staff will determine if PFAS detections in groundwater are a result of a release from a closed landfill facility. Central Coast Water Board staff understand the complexities related to background contamination and will work with the closed landfill operators to implement corrective action programs only when the evidence suggests that the impacts are a result of a release from the closed landfill. To do this, Water Board staff will evaluate all available information, including but not limited to site history and the extent of other known releases, groundwater elevation and groundwater flow maps, and general mineral data to evaluate water type and source. In addition, Water Board staff will apply the experience that we've acquired through the implementation of the PFAS monitoring program at active landfills. For example, by and large, the PFAS impacts to groundwater observed at active landfills has occurred in areas where other landfill-specific constituents of concern have already been detected. Water Board staff have also noted that groundwater impacts that are clearly a result of a release from an active landfill contain higher concentrations and greater number of detected PFAS than other locations where it's believed that there may be background contamination. The final general comment was concerning the consistency between the proposed general order and other landfill general orders in Region 3. The comments expressed concern that the proposed general order included more extensive monitoring than what's required under the active landfill general order and the closed, abandoned, and inactive landfill general order. The comments were also recommended that the PFAS monitoring requirements be postponed until a broader statewide approach was developed. Now, while it's true that the MRP for active landfills do not currently include PFAS monitoring, State Water Resources Control Board Order Number 2019-006-DWQ directed the regional boards to require active landfill operators to sample for PFAS. Following the state board order, Region 3 issued a series of California Water Code Section 13267 orders to require continued PFAS monitoring at active landfills. Central Coast Water Board staff intend to revise the landfill general orders or reissue site-specific MRPs to be consistent with this proposed general order within the next 2 to 3 years. Central Coast Water Board staff do not agree that the PFAS monitoring should be postponed until a broader statewide approach is established. While Central Coast Water Board staff recognize the concerns regarding the PFAS monitoring in this proposed general order, the protection of human health, water quality, and beneficial uses take precedence. While we did not make changes to the proposed general order based on the three general comment areas that were just discussed, we did make several changes to the proposed general order based on the feedback we received in our written comments. These changes include the removal of sulfide and boron from semiannual monitoring, modifications and reporting requirements to allow landfill gas to be reported in both parts per million and percent by volume in air, and of reducing the number of sampling events required after the installation of new stormwater monitoring points.
Excuse me.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, Ms. Hoskins.
I just missed what you said on the landfill gas. Can you just repeat that?
Oh, yeah. So one of the comments were that we allow for reporting in parts by volume, or sorry, percent by volume in air, rather than just parts per million. It depends on the type of monitoring device that you're using, but some report them in percent by volume. So we modified the MRP to allow for that.
What is the substantive impact of the change?
It makes it easier for them to report that value rather than having to make that conversion. To conclude, the proposed general order is largely similar to recently adopted individual closed landfill WDRs, but includes PFAS monitoring to evaluate and address potential PFAS impacts and thus ensure the protection of human health, water quality, and beneficial uses. The primary benefits of the general order are updated and clarified language, especially when compared to the older individual WDRs, and increased program efficiencies that allow staff to prioritize regulatory oversight of landfill activities with the greatest potential to impact water quality. Lastly, the proposed general order is consistent with the board's approach to protect water quality while ensuring high priority issues such as the human right to water, climate change, and disadvantaged communities have been adequately addressed.
Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, before going into the options, question I have is, can you comment if we have reviewed what our colleagues in other regions are doing in regard to closed landfills and PFAS, because I always like to remind ourselves we're not our own little island. We're part of the state of California.
Yeah, so we did speak to, during one of the recent landfill roundtables with all the other regions and state board, we notified them of our intent to include PFAS monitoring, asked what other folks were doing, and we will be the first to require PFAS monitoring. The other landfills have chosen not to do that at this point. Do you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, our understanding is the other regions, a lot of them feel like they don't have the resources to begin implementing PFAS, so they're hoping that state board will take up the baton and provide, kind of do a lot of the legwork to make it easier to implement. So we are the first in the state to, related to landfills, to have this requirement.
Maybe this was covered earlier, but what's the crystal ball timetable for state board to take on this task, considering our Mr. Oppenheimer comments about, you know, limited budget and staff reductions, et cetera?
We asked that question as well, and it's not clear. Last we were told is there may be a draft hopefully being circulated in the next couple months, but that's kind of been the same status quo where it's been recently, so we're not sure yet.
Okay.
I think we also asked Mr. McGuire yesterday, and it's been a consistent conversation that we've had as to what generally state board is going to do, what the direction is, and
right.
I think that we're waiting for a statewide approach.
Yeah, the answer was kind of a bit open-ended.
Agreed.
And that's why I wanted to circle back to see what other regions are doing in this specific area. Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And it's always gratifying to know we are in the lead. I always applaud staff for being able to accomplish some of our higher priority and more challenging regulations. I'm going to circle back and one more question on PFAS. I think you said that PFAS will be monitored for a period of 2 years, and then no PFAS is detected, and so they're off the hook.
So actually what the general order proposes is that after 2 years, if no PFAS are detected, that it gets moved to the five-year constituent of concern monitoring.
Yeah, that's program. What I was looking for, and I didn't see it. So thank you, because
yes, of course.
I would think that five-year period is something that should be upheld across the board.
And in cases when we might experience impact down gradient. If there are, say, cross gradient or up gradient background wells that aren't impacted, those as well are allowed to be moved to that 5-year COC monitoring time frame, mm-hmm. where the corrective action measure, corrective action monitoring would continue to monitor the mm-hmm. where there is known impact. So it's not like if you hit one detection down gradient, you're going to have to monitor all of your wells for PFAS semi-annually.
Okay, that seems reasonable. But I do think, since we are discovering the magnitude and extent of PFAS, that we can't assume that we're not going to continue to see that showing up. Yeah. So, and it's very troubling, of course. But thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments from my board colleagues?
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, and I just wanted to point out, as you all know, that we are a very heavy, groundwater-heavy dependent region. And we do have a lot of rurally located landfills that have domestic wells in close proximity to those. So that we felt like that's a critical component to why we're looking at PFAS at our facilities. And it may not be as critical for other regions potentially, but it has been a topic of conversation at roundtables for several years, since the State Board had required the sampling at our active facilities.
And we're the most groundwater-dependent region in the entire Correct. State, so I think that's significant. Okay. You have one more slide, I believe, Mr. Smyer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not sure how much we need the visuals on
that's
slide.
Fine. You can just okay. go ahead and thank you,
yeah,
Mr.
So
Packard
the
Mr.
options, the options for the board today are to adopt the proposed general order, adopt the proposed general order with modifications, or not to adopt it this time. Staff is recommending the adoption of the general order with the edits to provision 12 as described in the supplemental sheet. I'd be happy to answer any other questions at this time.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yes.
I have a couple of questions. Thank you for the presentation. And forgive me if I don't know this answer or the answer to this question. I didn't see the Casmalia Hazardous Waste Facility on this. I know it's an EPA Superfund site, so it may have been taken out of our oversight. Is that assumption correct?
Yeah, so I'm actually the one of the primary staff on the Casmalia site as well. That site is moving forward. We don't have a permit for that facility, but it is, as you mentioned, a Superfund site. DTSC is a lead for that facility, but regional boards are working as part of the IAC or the Interagency Committee with to represent the state's interest in that project. And they are closed. They are currently installing final cover systems throughout the facility right now, and there's ongoing monitoring and remediation at the site.
And there is no plan at this time for them to be enrolled under general order or this order?
No. In fact, they wouldn't meet the criteria based on who's allowed for coverage under this proposed order because they're a Class 1 facility. Mm-hmm. This permit doesn't allow for Class 1 facilities.
Yeah, and that makes a difference of Class 1.
Yes.
Mr. Rodriguez, I would like to ask Ms. Froelich to just weigh in.
Yeah, we are, as Mr. Smyra said, working very closely with EPA and DTSC, and we do have a role in the cleanup. In particular, there are many ARARs, which I always forget what that stands for, but maybe Nick can help me with that, applied, applicable.
Yeah.
Many of our laws and policies are worked into that record of decision for EPA, and we are closely involved in monitoring and in the cleanup that will be happening. I believe there's also installation of El Napa wells on site right now, too.
Yeah, that's correct. There's currently a series of, 12 deep groundwater monitoring wells that are being installed as part of the essentially the point of compliance for the DNAPL and LNAPL components of that site.
A couple more questions. I may have missed this during your presentation, but What is the proposed on-site mitigation if PFAS is discovered, or is that going to be a case-by-case?
That's really going to be a case-by-case, yeah. Our primary focus here is to identify if there's potential downgradient receptors. So if you know, and notify those parties and potentially update corrective action programs to address any impacted parties. Outside of that, it's going to be, you know, a site-by-site basis for what type of action is going to be taken to address any known impacts.
Thank you. And my last one is more of a comment. Looking at the three entities that submitted comment letters, I expect from a private company to voice objections, and as well as for the public entities, but you know, the one's a JPA, the other one's a county, and it's a little disheartening that they're concerned about money instead of the being able to monitor, you know, it's typically, you know, disadvantaged communities that are near these domestic wells that can be impacted, and it's just, for me personally, it's disappointing. And I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? And I do want to remind everybody we have a supplemental sheet. So we have one public comment, and I'd like to invite Ms. Carolyn Burke to the podium, please. And can we have 3 minutes on the clock? And if not, I'm happy to put my 3 minutes on my own clock.
Good morning.
Well, if we can just wait till we get the clock up, Ms. Burke, I'd appreciate that. Thanks for your patience. Yeah, I mean, I can do it too. That's fine. I'll do it. And I'll just give you like a 10 second head up, or do we have it? Go ahead, Ms. Burke.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Carolyn Burke, and I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the County of Santa Cruz and their Special Services Division that oversees our recycling and solid waste programs. We appreciate the opportunity to provide comment on expanding monitoring requirements for PFAS. We have serious concerns regarding the effectiveness of these requirements and urge the regional board to delay implementation and focus on creation of a broader approach to PFAS management before issuing regulatory requirements only for our region. Given the pervasive nature of PFAS throughout the environment and its continued use in manufacturing of household and industrial products, it is unclear how the detection of PFAS in monitoring wells would be a clear indication of the closed landfill being the only source of this pollution. And without evidence that the closed landfill is the source of PFAS, and in the absence of actionable steps to address the levels to a point that would be satisfactory for downstream use, the monitoring requirements as set forth in the draft general order constitute an unfunded mandate without a clear path to compliance. And while we understand the desire to obtain more data for a scientific evaluation, the county will need to divert funding from real needs and will invest $45,000 at the outset to upgrade well linings and ongoing monitoring costs of $30,000 over the two-year program period. So we urge you to please delay the implementation of these regulations until other regions can come on board to address all the stakeholder concerns and not just our own. For a unified state water approach to PFAS. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your comment. We appreciate you being here today. Yeah, we don't have any other public commenters. Yes, Dr. Wolf.
So, you know, circling back to, you know, the comment made specifically relating to the source of PFAS, you know, in our prior discussion, you know, I use the term closed system. So looking at the identification of PFAS With the well monitoring, would it be a correct statement to say that if PFAS are detected, the source would, I'll use the term most likely, because, you know, thing in science, we can never say 100%, that the source would definitely be most likely from within the landfill and not an external source of groundwater contamination coming from outside of the landfill footprint. Okay, so can you comment on that?
Yeah, so as I noted during the presentation, what we've seen, we're going to be using the information we've acquired through our years of PFAS monitoring in active landfills, and what we've identified is that by and large, we're seeing impacts in areas that are down gradient, unlined portions, and they're areas that we've already seen other landfill constituents of concern being detected. So that would typically be VOCs. We're also going to be looking at other potential tools. The monitoring is one tool in our toolbox to be able to identify source. The other tools include things like general mineral analysis and looking at preparing piper and stiff diagrams to look at different sources of water.
You need to speak a little closer to the mic. Thanks.
Yeah, so.
We're going to take a timeout. I think we lost our connection. Is that correct? Okay, so let's regroup. Apologies, Mr. Smyra, but we will reconvene in about 10 minutes or so when we get this up and running. Thank you. Ready? Okay. Thank you. Apologies for that technology. Well, we can't really apologize personally because it wasn't our fault, but technology fails. It's 11:37. We'll reconvene this meeting. Ms. Froelich, did you have something you wanted to share?
Thank you, Chair Gray. I'd like to respond to the comment that was just made concerning unfunded mandates. Investigations undertaken pursuant to Title 27 and or Water Code Section 13267 in order to protect the waters of the state because there's a reasonable suspicion that there could be a discharge of PFAS or PFOS is not a new program or higher level of service, therefore not an unfunded mandate.
Thank you very much for providing us with that clarification. So is there, yes, Dr. Wolf, you had further questions.
Not a comment. Before I was rudely interrupted by technology. Thank you very much.
Well, lack of technology.
Thank you very much. And basically, I think the bigger issue down the road is not going to be necessarily, you know, the cost of the testing, but I think it'll be important based on results is close. I'll emphasize collaboration and engagement with the closed landfill owners in regard to what mitigation measures would be, and perhaps the fear of the unknown is, you know, something that I read between the lines here. But you know, I have confidence that, you know, you and your staff will down the road work closely if we do find indeed that there's going to have to be some remedial measures to be taking place, particularly in light of the fact that we have a first region having these specific requirements. So that's just a general comment I wanted to make. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Dr. Hunter.
I will add to that because I certainly do appreciate counties and municipalities struggling with budgets that are constantly stretched and looking at ways to assure that your budgets are kept in check. In this case, I will say that the potential impact to the environment and potential impact for human health is something that we need to understand, and determining the source is important, but when we locate the potential groundwater impact by PFAS in particular, it's important for us to have an understanding of where it's popping up, where is it showing, and then from that monitoring point begin to understand where it may be, what may be the source of that. It may be the landfill, and as stated by Mr. Smyra, it may be outside sources, but we have to start at a point where we find it and then determine. And I appreciate Vice Chair Wolf in your comment and view on the importance of collaboration. Our intent is not to penalize counties or municipalities, but to engage in partnership with them to ensure that we protect groundwater quality and for the benefit of all of us. And so I hope the county sees this as a partnership and that we are interested in seeing these problems corrected over time. Nothing will happen immediately, and certainly data collection is one of those things that shows us trends and directions, and we rely on that data to help us manage and assure to our public, our residents in our communities, that we're doing everything possible to assure that water quality is maintained, the health of drinking, safe drinking water for healthy human sustenance. So I hope that I understand where the comment is coming from the county, but I hope you see that bigger picture as well. Thank you.
Yes, Board Member Harlan.
I think that we're all sympathetic with financial constraints of the counties and cities and other agencies, and adding another burden is not something that we particularly want to do, but I think we have to do it because of our mandate to protect water quality. I'm very sensitive to the underground water quality issues because of the number of domestic wells that we've had polluted that had to be closed because of nitrates and then having to provide bottled water to these communities. And the state has an extensive program of providing bottled water, and I think we do a really good job, but you can't really shower with a bottle of water. So I'm sorry that these things cost money, but I think it's necessary. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? So I will just echo my board members' comments as well, and I do appreciate you taking time and being here and representing your position. But I do think an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure, and ultimately we need to identify the sources and track back from there. So understanding that this is another requirement to have to comply with, but it's certainly one that is in the best interest of the health and safety of residents of Santa Cruz and the Central Coast in general. And I think identifying and working in collaboration with our staff will allow a best result for everybody. So appreciate the comments and understand the concerns. We don't take any of this lightly. Thank you. So do we have a motion? I do want to remind everyone we have a supplemental sheet.
I'll make a motion to adopt the proposed order R3-2024-0036, general waste discharge requirement for closed landfill facilities in the Central Coast region.
And I'll second that motion.
Okay, but we do have a supplemental sheet, so I just want to ensure that we're accounting for everything that needs to be included within the motion. Yes, Ms. Froelich.
May I make a suggestion to amend the motion? To amend it to adopt the order with the supplemental sheet, and then we can vote on just the amendment.
I appreciate that. Okay.
I will amend the order to include the supplemental sheet.
You'll amend the motion to include the supplemental sheet?
Yep.
Okay.
And I'll accept the amendment as well.
Thank you very much. Okay. Yes, we have a motion and a second. May we have a roll call vote, please?
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Rodriguez?
Aye.
Member Hunter?
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
Member Hoskins?
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. We appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Smyras. Thank you, Mr. Sisk. Great presentation. Appreciate all the work. Next item on our agenda is the Executive Officer's Report. Mr. Lodge, as the Executive Officer, please take it away.
Thank you, Chair Gray. The main part of the Executive Officer's Report for this meeting is an update on the Big Basin wastewater treatment plant system and the progress made since the project was referred to the Attorney General's office by the Central Coast Water Board in April of 2023. The facility has since been placed into receivership, and staff have been working with the receiver and contract operator to ensure proper operation of the wastewater treatment plant. The county has agreed to take over operations and ownership of the facility following a Prop 218 vote by the residents at that site. And we have Senior Water Resource Control Engineer Jennifer Epp available via Zoom if there are any questions on this project or further clarification needed.
Questions or comments on this project? Yes, Mr. Rodriguez.
I would like to thank staff for working diligently on this, and I'm glad that the homeowners are able to begin moving into their properties. Thank you.
I think that was your first meeting, is that correct? That was a heavy-duty meeting for you.
My apologies.
Yes.
Thanks to staff members and all the local people who worked together on this. It was a big, complicated project, and Jennifer's done a wonderful job. Thank you, Jennifer.
Okay. I wanted to thank Ms. App and Mr. Wildergay for their incredible efforts, really, to work with the community and the county on this really important project and get it across the finish line. So I know it took quite a lot. Yes, Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, and I, echo my colleagues, and this is a good example. When the other day I mentioned not all gallons are created equal, this is a perfect example where the amount of gallons of effluent here took a disproportionate amount of time to address both this technically and legally. Just a quick peripheral question. I recall that there were two issues. One was the water treatment facility, but if I recall, there was also an issue associated with a drinking water supply. Am I?
That is correct. So the drinking water
supply. And that's not within our purview, but it sort of goes hand in hand with the community. It's one thing to have connection to the sewer system, but if drinking water supply is an issue, it doesn't quite solve it. So right. It's more of enhancing a little bit my understanding of where things stand for the residents, if you have any info on that.
There is a receiver. The same receiver is also involved with the drinking water side of things, but I have to defer to Jennifer Epp on that if she has any update on the drinking water side. I know the Division of Drinking Water is working on that, as well as the Attorney General's.
Okay.
Yeah, I can do that. How's my volume? Can people hear me okay?
We can hear you, yes. Thank you both for being there.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for the kind comments. So yes, Executive Officer Lodge said, similarly, there's a parallel path on the drinking water side, and that is moving along, but moving along slower. It's a bigger system, more complicated, more expensive, and so we are having regular coordination calls, and ultimately, similar to the wastewater side of things, they're trying to identify an appropriate party that's willing to take on this drinking water system, and that's the big effort to try to find another entity that is willing and able to take on this system that they know needs a lot of repairs and upgrades and deferred maintenance. And so they're currently in discussions with a few different agencies and entities to try to see if there's any possibilities there, but it's likely going to be a bit of a longer process on the drinking water side.
So for clarification, the existing permittees who have connection, they do have access to drinking water?
Yeah, so the service area for the drinking water is larger than the service area for the wastewater. So if I recall correctly, maybe about 750 water connections and 30-ish wastewater connections. Everyone who has a wastewater connection also is connected to the same water company, but not everyone on the water company is connected to the wastewater. And there are areas of the drinking water system where there has been issues, you know, depending on where you're located, you know, when the particular flow goes down or a pump goes out or the generator, there have been lots and lots of boil notices. There's been issues where people have been without water. So service has been for quite a long time, not reliable and for this community. I do know based on the reports that we get through these coordination calls that we're doing regularly, that there has been some significant improvements in that. There's been some funding that has come in from, I believe it's the Department of Water Resources that has helped pay for things. So even just yesterday, there was a report that one particular problem area, some new equipment had been built and fixed. And so they're working on chipping away some of these issues, but reliable, safe drinking water continues to be not something that these people take for granted.
Thank you for the update.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you both again for being here. Thanks for all the work.
Thank you for the support back at the last board meeting. We've come a long way since then.
You've come a really long way, and it's been a marathon, and we really appreciate the endurance and the authenticity and just the support that you've given the community. So thank you very much. Yes, Board Member Harlan.
I forgot to thank Supervisor McPherson for his leadership on this and the County of Santa Cruz for providing money for this also, as we also provided a lot of money. But the county came up with some extra money, which really, really helped. So Supervisor McPherson and his staff members did an excellent job in making this happen.
Great. Collaboration is key. Thank you. Okay, any other items we want to discuss on the executive officer's report? Questions or comments? Okay. It's 11:52. I will adjourn this August 23rd meeting. Appreciate everybody's attendance. Thanks, everybody, for the good work. It's good to see staff. See you in a couple months.